Dylan's thoughts in a very simplified way. Eric Harris was more destructive, whereas Dylan was more self-destructive, I would say. I definitely was self-destructive and had an issue with cutting and suicidal thoughts and all that. And I know that Beck was sort of angry at his surroundings, let's just put it that way.
Then, one day in November 2007, Pekka pinged her online. He said he had bought a gun. He sent her a picture to prove it, and then he added, I think I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I remember when he said that he has a plan, and I asked, when are you planning on doing it? And he said, yesterday, I thought I'm going to do it today. Today, I think I'm going to do it tomorrow. And then the next day when we talked, obviously he hadn't done it, so I thought that he didn't really have a, you know, he wasn't, like, urgently pursuing to take any action.
She thought it was just talk.
And when he said that he's going to set his principal's office on fire, it just made it sound so surreal to me. And in a way, that was what made me think that he's not serious, because he's talking about setting his principal's office on fire, and you know, who does that?
Witnesses say the shooter was a student, that he walked through the hallways with a handgun, shooting into classrooms and through locked doors.
The 18-year-old who posted the YouTube pictures called himself Storm Spirit. It's thought the school principal is among the dead.
Vala was in English class when she got a text message that there had been a school shooting in Jokela.
And I remember reading that message like four times when it hit me that it must have been Pekka. And then there was this message from Pekka saying that today is the day that we're making history.
Vala said she still hasn't gotten over it. By the spring of 2008, she had stopped going to school and was seeing a therapist.
In a way, I'm just kind of disappointed that I didn't take his threats more seriously. But back then, I thought that I would have more time to talk him out of it and all that. But obviously, I didn't. He was just very troubled, I would say, and depressed. And it's just years of sort of being treated in a very not so nice way in a school kind of leaves its scars, I would say. Ever since Jokela happened, it sort of woke people up into knowing that things like that can happen in Finland also.
Do you think he wanted to commit suicide?
Yeah, he was saying that suicide is a waste if you don't make people see why you've committed suicide. If you don't make people see how they've treated you before doing that.
Suicide's a waste if people don't realize why it is that you did it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much what he was saying.
After the Jokela shooting, the government in Finland began to focus on bullying, and they went to Kristiina Sammivali, a professor of psychology from the University of Turku, to see if she could create a program to prevent it. What she came up with is something called HIVA.
It's an acronym also for two Finnish words, kiusaamista vastaan, which means against bullying. But HIVA is also a Finnish word, which means nice or kind or good, so we can say that some person is kiva, for instance, very nice to everyone. So kiva has two meanings. Kiva school is a school which is a nice school, but also a school against bullying.
Kiva is premised on the idea that bullies get power from the group that joins them. And if you can restrain the group, the bullying stops. Nearly half the schools in Finland, about 1,000 out of 2,300, have folded the program into their curriculum.
Hi, would you like to play?
That's one of the Kiva online games that children are asked to play.
Before you start, choose a character.
Sheldon Shy.
Hazel Helpful.
Gary Goodpile.
Olivia Ordinary.
Next, you will see a bullying incident in the playground. Some students are trying to get you to join in on bullying Kayan. Your task is to resist the temptations flying at you by blocking them with your shield. Blocking the temptations will make you stronger and reduce the power of the bullies.
One thing that we found in Kiva schools was that not only students were more eager to ask help from friends, but really the spontaneous support and help for the vulnerable peers or those who are victimized was increasing. So the students really, they feel more efficacious to intervene in bullying, and they also do it more often.
In Finnish schools using the Kiva program, the proportion of students reporting that they were bullied fell by 30% from 2009 to 2017. There was a 60% decrease in repeated bullying over the same period. Langman says that might take care of bullying, but it isn't a solution to school shootings.
Certainly, bullying, peer harassment, teasing, whatever you want to call it, can be one of the social stresses that puts a kid on the path of violence. I wouldn't see that as a cure-all, because I don't think bullying is the cause of school shootings.
I asked Dylan Cossey whether a Kiva program would have helped him.
It would have shown the person who's being bullied, not everyone's against you. There are people on your side. You are not fighting this battle alone, and there is hope for you.
Dylan Cossey was in a Pennsylvania detention center awaiting trial when Pekka opened fire in Jokela.
They put me in what they nicknamed the suicide suite because they thought being on trial might make me suicidal. I joked with them about that. At one point, they actually took away some of my clothes because they were afraid that I might hang myself with my pants, to which I joked, that's too humiliating a way to die. Just give me my pants back. And there was a camera in the room to watch me at all times.
One of the guards told him about the shooting in Finland.
And I just broke down. Apparently the rest of the staff had been there in case I had freaked out or tried something, but all I could do was cry at the time. And in a sense, it put me on both sides of the fence. That I was arrested as someone who was suspected of a plot, which even though there wasn't one, doesn't change the fact that I was suspected. And then was on the receiving end of someone who I knew, to a degree, carrying out a shooting. So I was both someone who people at the time were scared of and someone who felt like I had missed signs. So while people were asking themselves, did I miss signs with him, I was asking, did I miss signs with Eric?
You knew him as Eric as opposed to Pekka?
He used that almost like a first name sometimes. I never knew him as Pekka.
To this day, after spending 7 years in juvenile facilities and on probation, Dylan maintains he was wrongly accused.
I believed that every single one of my court dates, that the truth was going to come out and this was going to be it and I'm going to go home. People tried to prepare me for it. They said, you are not going home. There is no way. This is all over TV. It's on international news in some countries. You are not going home. But I never believed that until I was sentenced.
But it isn't hard to understand why police were worried. The judge was worried, too.
He believed that I was some kind of violent person ready to carry out an attack and that my mother was supplying me arms. The only reason that she had even bought a firearm in the first place was because I liked to go target shooting.
This is my little family gallery here. So this picture is Dylan. He's got this huge grin, and he had thick, thick hair, and he had a little blonde patch where his hair grew in whiter, you know? Mm-hmm. So he always had that frosty patch on the top of his head. And this is his one of his senior pictures. It was taken by a professional photographer. This was the picture that was on Time magazine where they said the monster's next door. But when you look in his smile, you don't see, there's no malice in it. There's no depression. There's no sneering.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I love that picture.
Is that what Dylan looks like? To you?
Yes, yeah.
We're not talking about Dylan Cossey anymore. These are pictures of another Dylan. This one is tall and thin and died in 1999. The gallery of family photos are on a wall in Sue Klebold's house just outside of Denver. You only need to be with her for 5 minutes to think about all the moms you've met who are like her. The kind of moms who would chat you up in the kitchen when you went to a friend's house for a sleepover. The kind who got pleasure out of feeding you.
I have like gluten-free things and dairy-free things I've got.
Sue Klebold actually gave me a bendy straw with my bubbly water.
I haven't had a straw in a while. Yes, I always use straws. I don't know.
She understands that it's hard for people to see her as that kind of mom. A good mom. How could she be if she raised one of the Columbine shooters?
Up until that point in my life, when I would hear the news and I'd hear that some person did something awful, I was blaming their parents in my mind. I was thinking, who could raise a kid that could do something awful like that? They must have been terrible parents. And then suddenly I was on the receiving end of that. I have believed for many years that blaming other parents very often is a way of making ourselves feel safer. When people truly believe that this was the parents' fault, it had to be the parents' fault, it removes the responsibility from everyone else.
Sue has spent 18 years trying to figure out if there was something she could do to change what happened.
I was hearing things about, you know, Dylan and Eric having no friends and sitting alone, and that completely took me by surprise because it didn't match what I saw at home, and that was our phone was ringing a lot, and boys called him and girls called him, and he was doing things with friends. So that didn't connect for me. But there was apparently an incident that occurred at school, and I can't remember when it was, but Dylan came home from school one day with ketchup spots all over his shirt. And I had said to him, what happened to you? And he said, I have just had the worst day of my life. I don't even want to talk about it. Later, after his death, I learned that there had been an incident in the school where he and Eric had been shoved around. Ketchup was squirted on them. I believe they were called fags by the other kids. And it was extremely humiliating, and I think it was one of the things that created an incredibly tight bond between him and Eric and put a vengeance piece into their thought process.
Sue knows more than anyone, it's more complicated than bullying. She believes Columbine was a murder-suicide.
I believe that Dylan's motivation to take part in the shooting came from his motivation to die. Dylan had always been my kid that sort of managed his life beautifully. He was a very self-reliant kid. When he was 10 years old, he asked me to teach him how to do his laundry. He was the kind of kid that no matter what it was, he always seemed to be able to handle it. What I didn't realize was that probably this trait in itself was harmful to him when his emotional development was compromised. He believed that he should be able to handle anything. And I think because of that belief system, it was terribly difficult for him when he was in pain and didn't understand why, when he was having social problems and didn't know what to do, and he didn't want to ask for help. And that own self-reliance made it even more difficult for him, I think.
Sue Klebold knows that to some kids, Dylan and Eric are heroes.
After the shootings, one of my friends who worked at a detention facility for boys told me that when the news came out about this shooting and the news portrayed it as an act of vengeance to get even for bullying, that the kids at this facility cheered, that there was in their minds, this was something that needed to happen, and it was kind of a getting even. That is, and it's such a horrible thought, but it speaks to, first of all, the distortion of the story and how it was portrayed and interpreted. What they did, it's become symbolic for people who feel left out, alone, vengeful, angry, hurt. And I think it's sad that people have to make heroes out of disturbed kids.
So I've talked to a lot of different kids who sort of follow them online, and they seem to pick one or the other that they identify with.
I wasn't aware of that, actually. I was only aware that many people have written me from all over the world, and young people have told me how they identify with Dylan, how they had similar experiences at school.
Kids who tend to feel more depressive and violent towards themselves feel a kinship to Dylan.
Yes.
And kids who are much more violent, and maybe outwardly so, feel a kinship to Eric.
I don't think that feeling of kinship with one of the other is surprising, because we cannot assume that the path to becoming a school shooter is the same path for everyone who ends up shooting. But I think the important message here that parents need to know and teachers need to know is just how strongly some kids are identifying with this behavior of shooting others and dying by suicide. I hope that if there is a positive legacy of Columbine, that one of those things will be our paying more attention to kids that need help and looking at things differently, stopping tragedies before they happen. That's where we need to help kids, before they get to this.
Dylan Cossey finally had a heart-to-heart talk with his dad when he was in jail.
It wasn't until I was in a visiting room that I knew my dad had been made fun of as a kid. That was not a story I had ever heard. But once I opened up, he opened up back to me, and in hindsight, I wish I had talked to them sooner. And that is advice that I would also give to anyone listening who feels the way that I've described. Try opening up, as hard as it is. Try it once. It can make a world of difference once you start to talk about it.
In our next episode, what could make a teen go from this?
I have emotional issues, I guess, and it's like hard to focus for me sometimes.
To this.
I'm more focused on what I'm doing. So like, that's like, I'm more aware of what I'm doing.
That's next time on What Were You Thinking? This episode of What Were You Thinking was reported by me, Dina Temple Raston. Caitlin Pierce produced the episode. Our editor is Martha Little. Sound design and mixing by Version Control, and fact-checking by Darren Ankrum. I'm the executive producer with Martha Little. This is Audible.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, right, loud and clear, yeah.
It's just been a quick 10 years since I last talked to you.
Is it 10 years?
Yeah, almost. 2008.
Bloody hell. Yeah, nearly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Mark Brain is one of those journalists you read books about. He was like that Woody Allen character in the movie Zelig, the one constantly in the back of the photo, quietly witnessing history.
And I joined Reuters in 1973. My first posting was to Moscow. At the time of the Apollo-Soyuz space flight and Nixon's resignation, the year in London, to East Berlin, Vienna. I covered Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia. Remember them?
I do remember them.
You know, another era.
But the reason I called Mark wasn't to swap journalism stories. I called him because in 2008, when I came home after a posting in Iraq, I was having some trouble.
There was a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder, classic stuff. Mm-hmm.
Like, I was scared of cars, I was hearing mortars, I couldn't read, is what I recall most of all. I couldn't get
That's
through
right.
the newspaper.
You couldn't concentrate, that's a very clear, concentrating difficulties, a very clear symptom of post-traumatic stress disorder.
So I should say here that Mark Brain isn't a journalist anymore. He gave it up years ago to become a psychotherapist to help people deal with trauma. His specialty? Foreign correspondence. I wasn't reporting in Iraq very long, only about 6 weeks, but it was a rough patch. Mortars were falling close enough to rattle the windows of the NPR Baghdad Bureau. When they land, it feels like the air is sucked right out of the room. In the spring of 2008, there were days when the whole of Baghdad was on lockdown. People weren't even allowed to leave their homes to get water, so it was stressful. NPR typically has correspondents who return from doing this kind of reporting talk to someone, just to check in. And the someone they asked me to talk to was Mark Brain, spelled B-R-A-Y-N-E. I know, sometimes you can't make it up.
when we talked in 2008, I remember very clearly when we spoke on the phone, and you were back in the States at that point, you were really worried that you were kind of permanently damaged. You couldn't make sense of your experience.
What I remember was that during a series of phone calls, Mark Brain convinced me I wasn't broken, that my problems were temporary and normal.
Because the brain and the nervous system are so busy processing the impact of overwhelming emotional and threatening and life-threatening experience that haven't got any processing capacity left over to read a newspaper or a novel.
Mark explained that my time in Iraq had put a little almond-shaped part of my brain called the amygdala into overdrive. That whole fight-or-flight thing, that's all centered in the amygdala. And when that's on high alert, it short-circuits the normal decision-making process.
Because that's how the brain responded at that time and made sense of the experience and allowed us to survive. Because actually, deep down, it's all about survival.
Just hearing Mark say that what I needed was time to leach all of those fight-or-flight chemicals out of my brain made me feel better. 3 weeks later, I read a whole book in one sitting, just as Mark had predicted.
People, once they understand, you know, I'm not crazy, I'm just human. This is what brains do. This is how people respond to the experiences I've been through. It gives them permission to be having a rough time, and it gives them a perspective.
And the perspective I got was that my brain was doing exactly what it was supposed to do. And now, in retrospect, I realize that whole experience started informing this. And this is What Were You Thinking? A show about adolescents, their decision-making, and how the simple act of understanding their changing brains can help them make better choices. I'm Dina Temple-Raston, and just as Mark Brain helped me understand my brain, in this episode, we're going to look at programs that help adolescents understand theirs. We'll explain why the years between 13 and 24 aren't just a terrible phase, but rather something young people can actually control and affect. And we'll show you how. You've heard the story. The decision-making part of the adolescent brain is immature, and that's why young people are impulsive, why they make so many poor decisions. We've talked about this in previous episodes, but we'll go a little further here. The idea of the brain's maturity isn't about the brain actually growing. It's about integration and how different parts of the brain are communicating with each other. We've referred to that process of rewiring before. It's called myelination. The first stage of myelination begins in the womb. The brain is beginning to make those connections in the brainstem, the cerebellum. Adolescent myelination is a little different. It's about making the optimal adult brain. And scientists now believe that process continues from the age of 13 all the way to 24 or 25. Things that the brain is still using as we get into our 20s are consolidated. And things that are essentially gathering dust, the brain discards those.
And it's one of the most clever things evolution has ever come up with.
Robert Sapolsky is a neurobiologist at Stanford University.
You're thinning out all those superfluous neurons and connections, and what they're being replaced with is myelin, which you could think of as sort of like plastic insulation on your neurons, which results in a much faster, more efficient system there.
About 3,000 times faster, actually.
So that by age 15, the, like, deeply committed, what's the theme song to the Teletubbies circuit that dominated your life when you were three, has sort of gone back burner. In a lot of ways, what adolescent brain development is about is leaner, meaner, more efficient, fewer circuits.
By the time the adolescent cycle is over, about 40% of the brain's synapses have been eliminated. 40%! And if it all goes well, what emerges is an incredibly effective brain, adapting and tailoring itself to live in a particular environment. It could be an Aborigine brain, wired up for hunting in the bush, or a Moroccan one that can move so seamlessly from French to Arabic and back again, like it's second nature. And now, researchers believe that the process is so slow because the human brain needs the time to get it right, to gather the experiences and knowledge necessary to make the optimal adult brain that not only reasons properly, but begins dealing with more complicated questions as well.
But what it means is you begin to ask questions like, what's the meaning of life? Why am I here? What's the purpose of, you know, anything.
UCLA's Dan Siegel wrote a best-selling book on adolescent behavior in the brain.
And these existential questions begin in adolescence, and the way an adolescent chooses to respond to those questions can set the trajectory, the pathway, the direction of the rest of their life.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين صلاة السلام على سيدنا محمد Je suis Zineb Hedra Je suis مرشدة depuis 11 ans
So Zineb Hedra has been talking to adolescents about these kinds of questions for the past 11 years. She's something called a murshidat, an Islamic scholar who spent years going to school so she can answer the pressing questions kids have about their place in the world and the role Islam is supposed to play in their lives. She lives in Morocco. The concern in Morocco, and we have this concern in the U.S. too, is that young brains are vacuuming up so much information, it makes them as vulnerable to bad influences as they are to good. And because this is a time in which they're searching for answers, looking for where they fit in the world, ideologies that provide simple solutions to their problems are particularly attractive. The Murshidat are trying to intervene in that process. We went to a Murshidat training center with our guide, Omar.
In English, IMEA, I think it's the center for training Murshidat and Murshidin, and Imam as well.
So, see the bottom line there?
Uh-huh.
That said, Il Murshidat wa Murshidit.
Yes, that's true.
There you go, my Arabic dusted off.
The Mohammed Sixth Center for the Murshidat sits on the edge of a university district in Rabat, the capital of Morocco. The place is beautiful. Big wrought iron gates swing into a succession of tiled open-air courtyards filled with fountains and flowers. Zineb, the woman we met earlier, was in the first class of students to graduate from the Murshidat program 11 years ago. Back then, the program was more of a shoestring operation, cobbling together teachers and classrooms in borrowed buildings. We're at the new and improved campus.
It's beautiful.
Hmm?
Look at the ceiling and the chandeliers and all the woodwork. It's quite stunning.
The Murshidat program got my attention because it was dispatching women out to the inner cities and countryside as religious scholars. And their job was to go find young men and women who were beginning to embrace radical Islam and set them straight. It isn't just a Moroccan thing. Kids I talked to in the U.S. who have been taken in by groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS were always telling me that they had lots of questions about being Muslim in America. And recruiters for those terrorist groups were willing to provide answers when no one else was. Maybe a Murshidat program, having educated Muslims explain the Quran to kids in the U.S., could help radicalization in America, too.
Madame Dina, vous parlez français?
Oui.
D'accord.
And the director of the program is Abdeslam Lazar. Abdeslam Lazar is tall and has the demeanor of a soft-spoken grandfather. His beard is clipped short, and he's wearing a traditional Moroccan gandoura. It looks like a long tunic. And there's a pillbox-shaped fez on his head. We've arrived during the tail end of exam time, and there was that familiar sense of relief in the air, that sense that all schools seem to have when examinations are almost done. Being a Murshidat isn't easy. The school only accepts several hundred students a year from all over the Islamic world.
De la Côte d'Ivoire. De la Guinée-Conakry.
And once they get here, they pay for nothing.
All the students live here at the Institute, and they don't pay anything to be here. We feed them, pay for all their books and tuition, and give them a monthly stipend.
The current enrollment is about 1,200, and about a quarter of each graduating class is women. The goal of the center is to train imams and religious scholars so they can answer questions about Islam and correct misinterpretations of the Quran, the director says. He doesn't mention ISIS and Al-Qaeda by name, but that's what he means. There have been quite a few young Moroccans who have traveled to Syria to join ISIS, and Al-Qaeda is thought to have had a hand in a number of terrorist attacks in Morocco since 2003. Countries like Saudi Arabia export a more extreme form of Islam called Wahhabism. We want to export moderate Islam, he said. The director then begins speaking French to make sure I understand his point and nothing is lost in translation. For the past couple of years, he says, we've relied on the military to combat terrorism on its own. Now, the fight is on two fronts, the military and the mind. In other words, the center is making a direct appeal to the adolescent brain. And they're using their women scholars to do that.
The women scholars here are really important to this effort, even more than the men. Women are the ones who have so much contact with the people, young people, other women, even men. If the Morjidats organize a conference, 450 women will show up. But if a male Islamic scholar tries to do that, they'll be lucky if 20 or 25 guys make the effort. The role women play in Muslim society gives them an opportunity to have such a huge impact. These are loving mother figures, and children and young people will listen to them.
The director then leads us into an enormous modern lecture hall. Every seat is filled, and there are about 250 students. The scholars in the first 10 rows are wearing white button-downs and hoodies, but it's in the 6 rows at the back that history is being made. They are filled with Morjidat women. The fact that the women are sharing a classroom with men is highly unusual for a Muslim country. Typically, they'd be in separate rooms. Yes, the women are in the back, but it gives you a visual representation of progress. They are in the classroom, raising their hands, asking questions, full participants. We went to go and meet a few of them.
Je suis Sanogo Wafa. Je viens de la Côte d'Ivoire.
Je m'appelle Latifa Halimi.
Je suis Wafa Msaouti.
Moi, c'est Aïdji Baba, Guinéen.
Je m'appelle Fatiha Al-Hamouti.
Je m'appelle Sadia Ouchen. Je travaille à l'Institut de Mohamed V de formation de Morshidine et Morshidat.
They explain that admission to the center is very competitive.
Déjà mémorisé le Coran.
Each of the women has already graduated from university and earned a bachelor's degree. Think of the Morjidat program as a kind of grad school. And while they don't have to take the GRE to get in, they do have to memorize half the Quran just to qualify for admission. That's meaningful because it can take years to memorize the Quran. When I was reporting in Pakistan, I went to madrasas where young men were rocking back and forth, desperately trying to commit the book to memory. Actually, understanding what they were memorizing was almost beside the point. The center in Morocco is just the opposite. This isn't about rote memorization. This is about interpretation. If you ask the women about the most satisfying part of being a Morjidat, they talk about helping the community and working with youth. But they also talk about how just being there has completely changed the way they think about their place in society.
Sont devenus moi mes arguments parce qu'ils disaient que, par exemple, les hommes sont supérieurs aux femmes.
I used to think that men were superior to women. 25-year-old Faitha El Famoudi told me.
Mais maintenant, moi, je vois que c'est le contraire.
But now I think the opposite. Now I don't think they're just equal. I think women come out ahead, she said. We aren't forced to work. We have a lot of autonomy. We can do a lot of what we want. And as Morjidat, we can have a profound impact on society, even more than men can, because we can talk to the young people and explain to them about true Islam, and they're willing to learn from us. So that's the training center, where this all begins. To find out how it's working on the ground, we went south, to Casablanca.
So this is like a whole compound that we've come to. There are a number of Morjidat who come here and meet clients or meet people who need their help. And now we're going in.
Remember Zineb Hedra, the woman in that first graduating class of the Morjidat in 2006? She says the first case she had after graduation had to do with radicalization. And it involved 6 young men at a local school.
I was working in the school and I noticed there was a group of young men. They were 13 or 14 years old, who clearly were embracing a form of radical Islam. I think I noticed them because they were wearing more traditional dress and they began arguing with teachers. I started to try to explain to them that Islam was a religion of tolerance and coexistence, and they resisted at first. This was 11 years ago, so the Murshidat were new and people didn't quite know what our role was supposed to be. Our religion tells us to be patient, but insistent, and that's what I was. I saw they were going in a bad direction, so I began counseling them 3 days a week for 6 months. They asked questions, and I gave them answers, guiding them back to the right path. It took a long time, but slowly they started changing their clothes and dressed like the rest of the kids. They started engaging more in school and stopped challenging their parents. Eventually, they got to the right place.
Zineb stayed in touch with a couple of the kids, checking in occasionally the way a friendly auntie might, just to see how they're doing. She says their brush with radical Islam was just that, a brush. Three of the six went on to university. All of them were working. And she says radicalization cases these days are rare. We wanted to talk to one of the six to see what he was doing today, and Zineb called to ask. She told us later that when she called him, he picked up the phone and told her congratulations were in order. He had just passed the officer's exam for the police. He would be getting a promotion. Zineb told us that when he said that, she didn't have the heart to ask him to tell his story. He was ashamed of that phase in his life, she said, and now he'd done something to make her proud. He just turned 25. Researchers now believe the adolescent period of myelination is a delicate time. If the process goes awry, it can have a dramatic effect. Researchers believe that some mental illnesses and behavioral issues begin to appear in young people's 20s, the tail end of adolescence, partly because something has gone wrong with the myelination process. And it appears that environmental factors, things like stress, can have a profound effect.
And if there's too much stress, you can actually prune down too much.
UCLA's Dan Siegel again.
Increased stress, for example, can increase pruning, which can reveal underlying vulnerabilities of the brains.
In fact, stress hormones in the brain have been shown to actually slow the myelination process and cut down the amount of white matter adolescents produce. Stress chemicals like adrenaline and cortisol appear to inhibit the process. Myelin is also known as white matter because it has a milky white color. And just for context here, you've heard of gray matter. Gray matter are the neurons and cell bodies where information is processed in the brain. So how can you guard against some sort of disruption during this delicate time? Relieving stress may be one answer.
Just allowing the eyes to gently close, or if you choose to leave them open, just lowering the gaze, allowing it to defocus, and settling into this period of sitting meditation.
So we're taking a trip to Simmons class, my English teacher. He's also my mindful fitness teacher.
Can you say that a little more enunciated?
Mindful fitness teacher.
We came to the Food and Finance High School in New York City to meet this man, a teacher named Brian Simmons.
Hi, you must be Dina.
I am.
Hey, Dina.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet
Thanks
you, too.
Thanks for having us.
So we're in transition right now. So we just finished a 12th grade English lesson.
And we came to see him because he's trying to ease kids through adolescence by teaching them about their developing brains and providing them with techniques that'll give them some control over those changes. At the school where Simmons teaches, about 80% of the students qualify for free or reduced lunch, and 90% are black or Hispanic. One of the classes they can take during their regular school day is something called mindful fitness. We wouldn't have dreamed about classes like this in my day.
Yesterday, we were talking about neuroplasticity. Someone remind me, what is neuroplasticity? Mariana.
Your brain, it shapes into, like, you know, you start looking at things in a negative way, and if you just think positive, your life is more easygoing and, like, peaceful.
So Mariana's right, right? Our brains change, right, depending on what we focus our attention on, okay? So neuroplasticity, you see there's an image on the board of a brain appearing to change. The brain changes itself. So this is really important to know. Scientists didn't always know this. They thought that the brain stayed the same for your entire life. It's important because we have influence over how our brain changes.
What surprised me is that the kids are completely focused on the lesson, completely comfortable with words like neuroplasticity.
So, but here's a little more specifically how it works. It's going to get a little scientific. If you miss some of the concepts, it's okay. We're going to simplify in the end. But I want you to see how it works. In your brain, there is something called a reward pathway.
The brain science is part of a broader effort to teach these kids how to focus, something known as mindfulness.
There is, in my view, a slight hysteria with people thinking that if you teach this, that you're trying to push spirituality on top of people. And the reality is this is neuroscience. It's being proven in the lab that this changes lives, boosts academic performance, makes people healthier.
To be clear, it's starting to be proven in the lab. Brain scientists will tell you that linking things like meditation and brain scans to adolescent behavior isn't unquestioned science yet. It's reasonable speculation based on what we know so far. Simmons says he's seeing it work in the classroom. His mindful fitness class is the only one like it in a New York City public high school.
So when we walk in, I always grab a yoga mat. It's right there. It's perfectly placed. And then I go and get a cushion and set up and wait until we start our meditation.
Nicole Marino is a senior at the Food and Finance High School. She's headed to the Culinary Institute of America in upstate New York when she graduates. And she loves the mindfulness training Simmons is offering.
I have, emotional issues, I guess, and it's, hard to focus for me sometimes.
She says Simmons' class has helped take care of that.
I'm more focused on what I'm doing. It's I'm more aware of what I'm doing.
Does it make you feel calmer? Does it make life seem calmer?
Of course. I feel less stressed. I used to be stressed about everything. I would be stressed about schoolwork, work, family life. But now I'm just I have everything on the same level. So it's not just one thing is more important compared to the other. It's just everything's on the same level, which I like, because I'm not stressed and I'm not thinking about other things.
So we are going to sit today for 8 minutes of guided meditation instruction. Does 8 minutes sound good to the room? Good?
Okay. Meditation in the classroom. It may sound a little squishy at first, but researchers are increasingly convinced that mindfulness, focusing on yourself in a thoughtful way, may be one way to help adolescents make better decisions.
So with mindfulness, there's one thing to just say one needs to be mindful. There's another thing to actually go through the exercises and do the meditations. And it's very difficult. I would say it's one of the most disciplined, difficult things I've done.
Beata Mogadem is the head of the Behavioral Neuroscience Department at Oregon Health and Science University. She's been studying the adolescent brain for decades and runs a lab dedicated to trying to understand it.
I have colleagues here who were with brain imaging. They were seeing robust changes in brain activation. And I'm this is incredible that there's these actual physical changes with just meditation.
Mogadem had been skeptical, and then she tried it herself.
I felt that my mind cleared up to be focused and goal-oriented and calmer in the sense of, not calmer in that I turned into a mellow person. I was, even more driven than before, but calmer in dealing with aversive events in a very logical way. It's hard to explain it, but it just those days where you really feel like you're at the top of your game, you're focused, it makes you feel that way.
There are a handful of studies looking at brain activation when doing meditation. And as a general matter, when doing meditation, the regions linked to high emotions seem to be less activated. And the areas of the brain that involve attentional tuning tend to be more so.
So it's a way to actually potentially deactivate that the emotional drive and bring online more the logical attentional tuning brain areas.
Which is exactly what you want to do for an adolescent. Get them to stop for a second.
It's not so much stopping. I would say meditation is not stopping. It's activating a different thing. It's empowering your mind to be activated in a way that's more constructive and better for you.
Robert Sapolsky has just written a bestseller called Behave, which connects brain science to why we do what we do. He's an advocate of mindful fitness.
Often, I think you get a good outcome with that. Hey, let's just calm down for a second here and think about if this is such a swell thing to do right now. And all that will be touched is the sort of inappropriateness of the impulsive sort of ways of trying to address that. I think that would be a great thing in lots of realms with adolescents.
They go to chemistry, global studies, English, and then they're in mindful fitness and they're doing yoga, down dog, meditating like you just saw. My whole feeling is that in an era of high stakes accountability, what educators have failed to do is to provide high stakes coping mechanisms to deal with the high stakes accountability.
Remember Mark Brain, the journalist turned therapist who helped me?
Is it 10 years?
Yeah, almost. 2008.
Bloody hell.
He has one more story we want to tell, and it's a personal one.
I was a very unhappy child, an exceptionally unhappy child, and I was consciously unhappy. I was miserable. And my parents divorced, and I was sent to boarding school, and, you know, it was 2 years ago. So that's now, you know, 65 years later. I did the Asperger's test, which has a 50-point scale, and 28 to 32 is sort of twilight zone between normal, what they call neurotypical, they call it, and Asperger's. And anything over 32 is Asperger's. And I'm 33. Today, I'm 33. And I cried at age 65. I cried with self-recognition. Because no wonder I'd found it so hard to be a teenager and a kid and an adult. And if I'd known, if somebody in 1965 had sat me down as a 15-year-old and gone through this and said, okay, Mark, you know, well, this is who you are and this is why you're finding it difficult because this is how your brain works. It would have transformed my experience of myself. It would have transformed how my parents, how my teachers would have worked with me. And God, I felt alone with my experience. But my goodness me, I wish I'd had these conversations that one can have these days. I wish I'd had that at 15. I would have had a very different life.
Wow.
I may not have ended up as a psychotherapist for a start.
Well, I, for one, am glad you did.
That's nice.
There's an analogy about how brain science fits into the explanation of human experience, whether it's adolescent or otherwise. Think of the brain science as a television set with its wires and computer chips and high-resolution screen. If you study it long enough, read the manuals, talk to experts, you could probably put into words how it works. Brain science is like that. We're just scratching the surface of understanding how it works. And what we know so far doesn't begin to explain Mozart's Requiem, or War, or Peace, or even exactly why an adolescent makes the decisions he or she makes.
It is such an exciting, wonderful field that I don't think human beings will ever actually seriously even begin to completely understand. But isn't it a wonderful journey to be on?
This episode of What Were You Thinking was recorded by me, Dina Temple-Raston, and Caitlin Pierce, who also produced this episode. Our editor is Martha Little, sound design and mixing by Version Control, and fact-checking by Darren Ankrum. Interpretation and reporting help from Omar Hamzawi, and voiceovers by Gina Yee and Graham Vickers. I'm the executive producer with Martha Little. Special thanks to Eric Newsom and Jesse Baker. And thank you also to Michael Herrera, Kirsten Hilleman, Robert Smith, Olivia Natt, Eva Wolshover, Norman Pratt, Bita Mogadem, and Brooke Dean for all your help. We also appreciate all the support from our legal team, Jillian Moranga, Lasharelle Morgan, Beverly C., and our voice coach, Dina Kay. This series would not have been possible without the willingness of people to share difficult moments in their lives. We deeply appreciate the trust you've placed in us. Eric Newsom is Senior Vice President of Original Content at Audible. This is Audible.